This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Well, some people go to college because it's 13th grade or because their parents want them to. Some go to pursue a profession. Becky Holmes went to Duke University on a mission. She was going to pull her own family out of poverty and address the food insecurity they experienced, along with more than 42 million other Americans. She just didn't know how she was going to do it. But a program to accelerate student business put her on a fast track to social entrepreneurship, a track that has been exhilarating and rewarding and anything but easy. Becky is the founder and CEO of the vegan dessert company Ello Raw, and she joins us now on The State of Things. Becky, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it, Frank.
Tell us about growing up in Pennsylvania near Lancaster, right?
Yeah, so Lancaster County, the thing I always tell people is, no, I'm not Amish, and that's a huge culture there, and I definitely, you know, appreciate it a lot more now that I'm away from there. But, you know, I grew up in a family, mom and dad, two other sisters older than me, and definitely, you know, in any sense of the word, very dysfunctional family. Father made below poverty line of income. And so it was definitely a hard life growing up. But I think at the time, you know, that was all I knew. So like any kid, you know, you grow up and that's just life. And so it was hard to see, kind of think about when I realized that, oh, I don't have the resources other people have. So I just remember kind of facing as a kid, pretty much every sort of issue out there has touched my family in some way, shape, or form, whether it was drug addiction, teenage pregnancy, poverty, fighting, abuse. Kind of saw it all. And definitely as I get older and reflect on it, really realizing how that's shaped me to who I am.
And to also sort of to amplify some of this, I mean, all of that was going on, but your father had a college education, mm-hmm. worked very hard.
Yeah.
So it's not a question of neglect so much. I mean, a lot of effort is going in. Talk about your father. He got a college education,
yeah.
and the jobs that he had.
Yeah. So he actually had a graduate with a Bachelor of Science from a university down deep in Arkansas, and studied speech and audio pathology pathology and really wanted to kind of do that. And so I think what happened was, you know, him and my mother, they were married at the time, and she got pregnant with my first sister, and my dad just, you know, needed to bring some food, put it on the table. So he just got the first job that was available, and it was more of an entry level worked for a battery company, and sort of has kind of been stuck in that for the past 30 something years. And just really, you know, after each kid, just really never found a way to get out. And it was always like, you know, I want to advance and I want to go to school or do this, but I have to pay bills. I have to make ends meet, and we can't do that, you know, without my salary.
So what did that mean for you as a young girl growing up? I mean, were you focused on school? Were you focused on the home? Where was your attention?
I think one thing as a kid that kind of separated me from my sisters was I was very aware and observant. And so as much as I put a lot of time into school, when we were home, I was very observant of what was happening. I remember so many nights being 5-4 years old and sitting on the top of the stairs in the middle of the night, listening to my parents screaming downstairs and, you know, my eyes tearing up, but just trying to think like, what is this? What does this mean? And how do I fix it? And I remember my sisters being asleep and one kind of every so often coming to the stairs and pulling me and saying, Becky, go to sleep. But I always just wanted to know it. And I always was kind of keeping tabs on what's going on and why is this the way it is and how can I help? And I think that as much as I did that, I also pulled a lot towards school and it became my refuge and it became something where I know that when I go to school and I fill out these forms or I take this test or I do this project really well, people, you know, they smile at you and they say, wow, Becky, that's amazing. And I think that started to really fuel me. And I love that. And I love putting that time into school.
Curious to see how your mind sort of evolved over time, 4 or 5 years old, asking yourself, what is this? What were some of the answers that you came to very, very early on?
I think one thing, too, that was interesting with my parents is I felt like I became a parent in the household very early. And so even though I was actually the youngest daughter, I sort of became that glue of the family and became the rock that people went to. And so I realized that very early on, somehow I could sort of hold onto my emotions and be very sort of objective and listen to my parents and sort of be that mediator. And I don't know, you know, maybe I think that I was just forced to do that, that I knew no one else was doing it and everyone else was fighting, you know, fire with fire. And so I felt like if I could listen and sort of take it in and say, okay, how can I help? Or, you know, how are you not understanding this person? Or what can we do?
You're very curious. I mean, when you think about being that young
yeah.
and simply not having the resources to fix anything,
yeah.
the thing you learn is, well, the thing I can do is listen.
Mm-hmm.
So you do that because it's something. And because, again, without the resources to stitch it all together again, you at least become a good listener and a good student and eventually got a scholarship to Duke, right?
Yes. Yeah. So it definitely that focus on school paid off. And I think the more I got to middle school and then high school and realized, wow, I'm moving towards the top of my class and teachers are telling me I can, be something. And I know from a young age, my dream was to be president. I always told every single teacher, I'm going to be president. I'm going to invite you to the White House. So
you don't have the hair for it, but go ahead.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I diverged from the political scene and realized that I wanted to, do good through business instead. But I ended up working hard and just somehow never, although society was telling me I should have had a box around me and I, should have had my sights shouldn't have been so high. I never had that limit. I knew, okay, I want to go to a top school and I want to be successful and I want to have a different life than I grew up with.
What were your parents saying and your sisters, the rest of your family about all this?
Yeah, I think they've always been supportive. And I think the biggest thing, maybe they're jokes, maybe they're not, but I've always heard, all of my sisters like, well, you're going to go make the money and then you can pay for my kid to go through college, or, Becky's going to be the successful one, or, my dad's always like, you'll take care of us. And so, I mean, it is a lot of pressure. It's always been a lot of pressure. It's, easy to say it lightheartedly, but I always have felt that I was sort of my whole family's ticket out. And so that's always been something on my shoulders.
Then you get a scholarship to go to Duke. There's all this pressure on you. And again, there are some class distinctions, I'm only guessing, at
yes.
Duke. How'd you feel?
Yeah, so Duke was a whole new world, and it definitely was the place that really allowed me to make, this my thoughts and dreams into reality and gave me those tools that I didn't have access to. I think it was in Duke that I realized that there is this disparity between, we all came from different walks of life, and I saw it. And I saw that was, I think, the first time I realized, what I went through wasn't normal, quote unquote. It's different that some, these people don't have to deal with that they have these resources that, they want to go do this and they're doing it. They're investing in this, or, their idea for what they want is a 7-figure income in the next 3 years. And that's real to them. But to me, I was trying to struggle with, all right, how am I going to get my library books, or how am I going to get my books for class, or how am I going to, help my parents back home? So just the difference, it was really apparent there.
So you make the observation kind of as an intellectual point. That you take, but what about emotionally? I mean, was it difficult for you to fit in or feel like you weren't fitting in or not?
I think I had grown up always being good at hiding things. Denial was my middle name. I was the happiest kid from, birth till now, I'm sure. And so I was always good at hiding things. And I knew that was just what we had to do. Like, you never talked about home life in school. And so when I got to college, it was easy for me to put on this face and, again, to observe and to watch people who came from a different class and sort of how they acted and their cultural capital and how they behaved. And for me to sort of acclimate to that and figure out, how can I fit in there? And they don't need to know about my past. Let me just become that person to make it with the rest of them, because that's what I want.
And you wanted to do what? What was your plan going to do?
Yeah, so when I got into Duke, I was going to major in political science and international comparative studies. Again, I think I wanted to be president. But then the first classes I took, I was part of this focus program, and I had incredible focus, and I took these two courses, one on education reform and one on basically just social justice. And so it was really interesting for me to kind of look at social justice in a new way and say, how do we help people? And it's not just, going on missions trips and giving to people and just realizing how a lot of times that can have adverse effects. And so I think it really reshaped my mind on like how I can make an impact and how I can make a difference.
Then you got to selected for an entrepreneurship program. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the Melissa and Doug Entrepreneur Program, it's an incredible program that started at Duke, and I was part of the first class of that. That's really what allowed me to sort of take everything I'd learned at Duke and really make it a reality. There's incredible programming through that and out of the Duke Innovation Entrepreneurship Initiative, which is also incredible, and really gave me the tools and the means and surrounded me with people and mentors who could help me along the way and really provide me the resources that I never had, and allow sort of fill those gaps. And it also came with a small stipend for the summer to really either work on a internship or work on a startup. And that was when I said, okay, if I want to start a company, it's now or never. I'm just going to go for it, because if I fail, at least I can come back for senior year and, work on something else.
Did you have an idea for a business?
I did. So when I started off, I I was really, earlier that year, I had gone through a tough breakup. And so I channeled all that energy into health and fitness and something I could control. And so I had just fell in love with wellness and was learning all these things where, you know, when I grew up, nutrition was never a thing. We ate McDonald's, we went to shelters and got free food. Nutrition was not a thing. It was just, you know, how do you not be hungry? And so when I realized that what we eat affects how we live, I wanted to create better products than the ones I saw on the market. And I would go to the store and you'd see, you turn it over and there's sugar and chemicals. And I said, why can't we just have a company that makes good, nutritious food that's just, you know, a clean ingredient? So that's where I kind of started. And it shifted a little bit from a plant-based protein cream cheese, which I realized eventually was not my passion. I don't really care about cream cheese. It was just like a hole in the market. So I learned early on, you know, you can't just follow where you see the economic gains. You have to follow like a passion. So then I went into these dessert bites. And the story behind why that exactly is I was at the beach with my two sisters and my one sister's husband at the time. And we'd went to a raw vegan cafe and, you know, we were eating these green grass juices early, you know, people, not everybody can do it. And then my brother-in-law had one of these raw vegan donuts and he loved it. And I think that was a moment when I realized.
Now, was he a raw vegan guy?
No. He was a hamburger, cheesesteak, soda kind of guy. So the
He's like, hey, rolling his eyes at this whole thing. He can't wait for this to be over, right?
Yes.
Now he gets the vegan donut.
Yes.
And he's in heaven.
He loved it. And so, and I think it was all joke to him before, but he said, Becky, this is what you should make. And so I think that was my aha moment of if I can make something, like if something this healthy can taste so good to, again, where I came from, the people who eat the things that I ate growing up, then maybe I have something that can really disrupt.
Meanwhile, the clock is ticking on this internship of yours, right?
Yes. Yeah. So I had a summer basically to try it out to make it happen. And in fact, I wasted or not wasted, but used up about a month and a half of it trying to make random cream cheeses in my kitchen and taste test with my dad. Bless his soul. So I got the point. I said, this is it. And I knew, I remember calling up my advisor at the time, Howie Reed from Duke I&E, and saying, I'm going to switch to these like donut holes. And he was like, great, that's great. I'll match you up with some people. Let's go. So I really took the ball, you know, got the ball running and just went for it and just worked really hard and ended up having actual product within a few weeks, getting a license for it and bring it to a market.
Now, the actual product you have to make, right? Test kitchen. So how's that going?
Yeah. So we started in getting my, you know, home kitchen licensed for that. And then we moved into actually renting from a co-op. And then we also moved to renting from another, you know, food producer. And now, as of a few months ago, we have our own commercial kitchen in Raleigh, North Carolina. So really exciting. It's close to downtown, and it's the space that we can really grow into and scale.
Who did the testing, the taste testing?
The taste testing. My friends and family, I think, you know, they always say start with them. And again, getting it out to people who are going to be objective with you and not just say, oh, they're great, Becky. Mm-hmm. So that's where it started. And then again, I knew that I had to get it in front of customers as soon as possible. So I brought it to a market and just had people, you know, random people test it, try it, see if they would put money and buy it. And I think that's really how you start a business is you could have the greatest idea in the world, but if nobody wants to buy it, you have nothing.
Well, there's a lot of other things that you need. And I want you to talk about that because there's nobody who's listening right now who cannot hear your passion and your energy. And they're saying, wow, you know, that's what you need.
Yeah.
That kind of spirit, that girl can go do anything. But if you had just been in Lancaster, Pennsylvania and had this epiphany that maybe this thing would work and you made it and you didn't have these connections, and I want you to talk more about the kind of connections you got through this entrepreneurship program, how they're talking to you about business connections, who they're putting you in touch with, who you wouldn't have known about had you been there. I mean, those are the things, that's the portrait I'd like you to paint now.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And, you know, if I had started in Lancaster and hadn't had those, you know, connections, I don't think it would have gotten far. I think I would have had that energy, but I would have been bouncing around saying, what do I do? And nobody would have known what to tell me. And so I think at Duke, you know, Howie, this mentor, pairing me with people, whether it was Melissa from Melissa and Doug, who run the toy company that started this initiative, and saying, okay, we can help you figure out distribution, or here's someone who knows design, or talking to another local entrepreneur, Tom from Tom and Jenny's Candy, and saying, here's what we did at the market, and here's how we price this out. Tatiana Bergeson from Mati Energy was a great mentor, one of the main mentors in helping me get it started, and she was the one who brought me to my first Whole Foods meeting and said, okay, tell her everything bad about the product, and she was so blunt, and she said, here's what you need to do, and now just do it.
And she was somebody else who basically went through that program, right?
She was in sort of an affiliate program of it, yeah, that the school had started before, but she is now one of the mentors of the classes that are in it now.
These are successful business people who are connected, and then other folks who can help you will listen to them and say, oh yeah, I'll give you a hand.
Yeah.
If you'd have cold called them from Lancaster, they might not have found the time. And this is the key, this kind of social capital that's connected, mm-hmm, to financial capital. They're wealthy people who are doing, or the successful people who are doing well. So now you've got the picture of how distribution works. That's a thing. I've got to know how to do it. How design works. I got to make this thing look right. It's not just a product. And eventually you did get it to Whole Foods, right?
Yes. Yeah. So January of last year, I woke up and was going through my emails. I know you're not supposed to do that in the morning, but flipping through my emails, and I see this email from Whole Foods. And I think at that time it was a low point, and I was, you know, getting no after no and just sort of assuming the worst. And I opened this email, and I remember it saying, welcome to the family. And that was one of the best feelings in the world, to know it's still going to be a journey. It's not over, but like someone else is saying, you have something great. And that was one of the best feelings.
You're just like getting a note from Jeff Bezos.
Yes.
Now you're working for him now.
Exactly.
So, again, I want to talk more about the kind of things you learn about making the pitch, just how you do that, how you go to a place like Whole Foods and say, I've got this thing. Because you know a lot of people are going to them every,
yes,
single day with their donut holes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you do, and what did you learn about that you... How did your intuition compare with what you learned? In other words, what really took you to the next level?
Yeah, I think one thing that set me apart was that I was never afraid to be wrong, never afraid to fail. And that's something, you know, the earlier you learn that, the better off you are. So I knew that how I was going to learn was not to sit and think about how it might work, but to go up and just learn on the spot. So I remember the first call I had with a wholesale, store. I got on the phone. They start asking me some questions. They asked me the case size. I had no idea what that meant. And so I just said, 10 bags, just made up and wrote it down. Okay, 10 bags. So I would remember later. And so I think a lot of it was just throwing myself in it and learning as I go, because,
yeah,
that's the only way you're really going to understand it. You can't learn it from books. You have to throw yourself into it. And I think the mentors along the way who could give me those extra pointers that, you know, scaffolded my learning was also very helpful.
This is not a rags to riches story yet. You're still in progress. And in fact, even along the way, I mean, you found yourself kind of living hand to mouth, right?
For sure. I would say the last year, probably starting last summer, I'd come out of a fellowship program, a residential program in Raleigh. And I was really, you know, I didn't have enough money to support myself and the company. And so I was at this crossroads of, do I give up? Do I try to get a corporate job, or do I keep going? And at that point, I realized I have the energy and the passion to continue doing this. All it means is that my life is going to look a little bit different than my peers. And so at that point, it meant living out of my car. And that was a sacrifice that I said, it's worth it to me to put that money into the business and to run with this. Because I think I always know that even if I'm going through trials and struggles, it's temporary. It's not forever. And so I see that vision of me getting out of it. And so I'm willing to sacrifice now to be able to reap those rewards later.
Let's talk about this other mission, which is to get wholesome food to people who need it and people who should be eating it. Okay, your brother-in-law eats the donut hole at the vegan place, although he was dragged there over his miraculously over his dead body. He ate it and he liked it. He's not going to go to Whole Foods.
Yeah.
And part of the reason is, and again, if you talk about your family who, as you say, every once in a while would go to food pantries to feed themselves, there's a price point here that's an issue. How did you address that?
Yeah, that was a big, I think, moral or dilemma. And I had to really think about is, how do I make a product that my own family can't afford, but this is the business I want to be doing? And so I really had to think, do I subsidize the product? Do I create a less quality product, not focus on raw and organic, create something that's, you know, cheap? Or do I focus on something that's profitable? And so I think I kind of had to turn off my conditioning of what I came from about, you know, giving and like the handouts or just low cost, and had to say, let me create a profitable business that I know once it's growing can give back. And so I really had to say, this is the margin. I know right now the market that's purchasing it is not going to be, you know, where I came from, but I know eventually we'll be able to give back and to also help shape this landscape of organic foods and the availability, and that will drive down costs.
Just to normalize it,
make
it the normal thing, which,
yes,
does perversely drive down costs because you actually bring more processors and more,
yes,
farmers into the business, which actually, you know, increases the supply and therefore can control the price. So it's normalizing as well as perhaps becoming so profitable you can give back. Well, I want to pursue this a little bit more, so stay with me, Becky Holmes. She's the founder and CEO of the vegan dessert company Ello Raw, and she is my guest today on The State of Things. We'll continue our conversation after this. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest is Becky Holmes. Struggled to break out of some poverty in Pennsylvania, but now is selected for a prestigious program at Duke and set her on a path to social entrepreneurship. She is now the CEO of the vegan dessert company Ello Raw. And my guest today, what? Tell us about the name, Ello Raw.
Yeah, people always ask about the name. So I always tell people, you know, I just feel like it's a fresh take on hello, just, you know, hello to a new lifestyle. But I first tried my, you know, entirely vegan raw dessert in London. So the whole hello kind of became a fun little throw on it.
What about, again, this idea of having the energy and the idea, but without the capital and without the support, being able to start a business? As you think about that now, I mean, and going back into your community, how many people that you grew up with who could probably be doing something like this if only they were kind of born on third base? You ever give that some thought?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's, you know, we see where people are, but we just don't know how to get there. And some people grow up in families where they know how to get there because their parents are doing it. And some of us grow up in families where we don't know how to do that. It just seems like, you know, off in the sky. And so I think one thing that really helped me without having the resources and economic means is being very lean and how I started the company and ran it from the beginning. So there's a book called Lean Startup, really helped me realize, you know, I don't need to start a huge company right this moment. I don't need to make 1,000 bags of product. I need to make 5 and I need to sell those 5. And then with that money, I can, you know, make more. And so really starting to figure out, it doesn't have to be perfect, but it has to be something. And so every, you know, little by little, the logo, people spend thousands of dollars on logo and branding. My sister hand drew a leaf in Ello Raw, and I got it digitalized online for $5. And that actually is my logo to this day. We're hoping to do a rebrand soon, but you know, that's what lasted. And same thing with the bags. When we first went to market, they were bags we got at a craft store, and we just stuck the label on it. Everything was very lean and resourceful because, you know, when you don't have a lot of means, that's how, you have to be very creative right. In how you get there.
What were some of the big mistakes that you made along the way that you really learned from?
Yeah, I think you know, I'm always a person who doesn't focus as much on the failures and the bad. I try to, you know, put it away. And so you always get asked this question. I always have to really dig deep. And I think there are a lot of decisions that you just make and things that I didn't know, you know, at the time. And I think now, okay, I could have done, you know, what I've done in 3 years, I could have done that in 6 months now that I know what I've known. But, you know, just little things on not realizing how important credit was in the beginning and trying to, you know, okay, maybe if I'd grown that first and then I could have got a, you know, bank loan to fund. Just a lot of it was just ignorance at the time and not knowing it and not having enough people to tell me, oh, don't do that or do this. But luckily I was able to just bounce back from each one, use it as a learning and continue moving forward.
Again, to make the comparison between people who have and want to take the energy to bring an idea to market and those who start where you did. And not to put more pressure on you, but if you do fail now, the idea of getting credit and restarting, I mean, there are people who can go bankrupt 4 times mm-hmm. and still come out on top. And in your case, I mean, you're living on a much, much thinner ice, aren't you?
For sure. I think failure is, yeah, it's not an easy, you know, wouldn't be an easy thing to really to have. And so I think there are probably 6 months ago, a year ago, when many people were telling me and should have been telling me to, you know, to give up and to stop and to get more stability. And I've, you know, heard that a lot. And I think I always knew that I have to push through and I know that this is something and I'm going to keep going until it gets there. And so I think that with my mindset, I know if I lost everything and if it failed, that I've grown so much and I've learned so much that I'm going to start something else. And I think the great thing coming from where I came from, I know how to survive off of nothing, right? I don't need a place to live. As long as I have a car that's moving and, you know, the ability to walk and talk, I'm gonna make something else and I'm going to make it happen.
What's your family think of all this so far?
Yeah, I think in the beginning, they're definitely encouraging and thought that was great. I think there's definitely a phase where I was really struggling, and a lot of them, my parents said, you know, I think it's time to get a job. There are many times my dad said, just come back, just live with us. And he doesn't really handle that stuff well. So he was like, just come back and live with us and it'll be fine. And my mom was really pushing, like, maybe you should get a job. And I just knew, like, I knew it was something and I knew that I could keep going and that it would be worth it. So I just kept pushing.
You also said that they didn't want to hear about the downside. It was, they had enough trouble, right?
Yes, that was huge. It was, you know, anytime I, again, growing up and always feeling like I was the parent in the relationship, I never felt like I had people to run home to and like just cry and say, I don't know what to do. Help me. I'm lost. It was always about their problems. And that was sort of what came first. And so I learned to hide that. And so that, you know, even now when I wanted to go back and be like, I'm struggling, their reaction was not what I wanted to hear. It was a quick, you know, it wasn't empathetic. It was a quick, well, we have these problems and this and that. And so, again, it just became this thing where I knew they weren't the people I walked through my struggles with. They weren't going to be that support role in my life. And I had to find other people or myself.
Talking about entrepreneurship in this environment and the blend of competition and cooperation, because it seems to me that you did cooperate and people cooperated with you who could be seen as competitors to you. They're also marketing a product in this price range, and they were helping you. What's the blend of cooperation and competition in the market these days?
Yeah, I think you know, the triangle is a very fierce place for startups and competition and resources, and that's a very real thing. I think at the end of the day, too, though, you realize not, as an entrepreneur, is that, you know, everybody has ideas, but it's who puts them to action, right? It's who takes the steps and makes them reality, and not a lot of people do that. So even giving advice to potential competitors, you know, whether they take it or not is up to them. And I think that there is, especially among the Duke community, I notice, and alumni, there is this collaboration. We realize that, you know, everybody can be successful. It's not, you know, like they're eating away at one pie. Everybody can be successful. And there's a way to, you know, for everyone to be able to grow and find a little part of this, you know, the rewards. And it doesn't have to be a every man for himself.
Well, is it just altruism? Or do you think, and this, I did like this, you know, your perspective as a person who's really in the thick of it and competing now, you know, at the very basic level, is cooperation essential to good business, or is it just a thing that at the end of the day, if you've got a couple extra minutes left over, you donate as a kind of kindness?
I think my philosophy would be that it is essential. I think that, you know, when you do good business, it comes around, whether you believe it's karma or just, you know, what you're called to do. I believe that when you help people, you know, that comes back, and if you're always doing the right things, it's going to work out. Maybe right now it feels like if I just, you know, focus on myself and didn't help anyone, I'd be better off. But in the end, I always feel like if you do good and you help people, that eventually they're going to come around and they might help you, or it might get you to another place. And I think that you, if you do bad business, it's going to come back and bite you. And that's just not how I'd want to live my life.
You talk about this business growing it and being successful in part so that you'll have something that you can give back. Are you at a point where you can think about that, how to partner and how to make that work?
Yeah, so that was something I started from the very, very beginning, saying, okay, I know I only have a little bit of, you know, money, we're only pulling in a little bit of revenue, but how can I still go towards my mission of making healthier foods available? How can I still make steps? And so we did a few little things. The one, one January for my birthday, I had people make donations, and we filled a part with donations, and then some of the revenue, we filled an entire tub of healthy snacks, and we gave it to the rescue mission in our community. And then in last summer, we ended up taking, for every certain purchase that was made on our website, we donated to summer meals. A lot of people don't realize that for some kids, their only meal throughout the entire week is at school. And so when school's out, those kids are left with, you know, not a lot. And so having summer meals and people that provide that is really crucial. And so we've tried to find these little ways to give back. And even if it's educating or just volunteering myself, and I think as the company grows, that's something that will become more of a staple and more of a steady thing in the company.
When you talk about the company growing, how do you see this company expanding?
Yeah, so we're lucky recently actually just closed a small amount of investment from a local angel investor and are really excited about that. It's been a long time coming. It's been a lot of other, you know, the investment road is a whole other thing. And as someone who's never walked it before, but that's really exciting because it now having these means to really take this vision somewhere. And so Whole Foods was a huge thing that we just started growing in the triangle. And that's something we want to continue expanding our retail presence, you know, through wholesalers as well as online. And I think at the end of the day, I want the company to be a brand name that is a national household brand that people know that it's a company that they can trust, that's honest, that when you go up and you pick up a product that says LO Raw, you don't even have to turn it over and look at the ingredients because you know that we are putting the best things in it.
What are some of the products you have in mind, or do you yet?
Yeah, so right now we've been starting with these dessert bites, little balls of dates, nuts, spices. We have four flavors right now, and I'd really like to get to a place where we have, you know, maybe 20 really eclectic flavors with different superfoods and fruits, and have a huge variety. And
I tuna. Think tuna. I want a tuna donut bite.
No tuna. No, it's got to be plant-based.
Nobody listens to me. See, that may be the reason my idea failed, but you go ahead.
But so I think the one thing a lot of people get wrong is that they try to do everything at one time. So really, I think focusing on these bites and doing it really well at first. And then there's definitely room for other product lines that are, you know, match our mission.
You know, you talked about investment and the investment stream, and it does strike me that more and more people now are becoming socially conscious and realize that you can make an investment. You don't just have to make a donation to have your money do well. There should be ways to invest in more than just a socially responsible company. I'm going to invest in a company that doesn't beat its employees. Okay, well, that's good. But could I invest? How do I find Becky's good idea? Isn't there a stock market? If you thought about, not that you have plenty of time to think about these things, but investment streams, small stock markets where investors could meet entrepreneurs like you and put their money where their mouth is.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of people who are trying to focus more on investment, even with stocks, you know, investing in companies, that do well. And I think we are becoming more conscious consumers, and I'm seeing that as our market grows of customers. And I think it's important to, sometimes it's hard for the companies that are doing good and don't have the resources to be heard, you know, the bustle and the hustle of everything here, especially in the Triangle. And so I think if investors don't just go along with their peers and their friends and the big companies, but they say, okay, let me try to find, you know, these gems, right, that are hidden. Let me find a good person who has a great work ethic, who's hustling, but just needs that little bit of capital, and let me fund that and fund their mission. So I think that we'll start to see over time the people who are doing that and are funding the good missions and the good people behind them, we're going to see that pay off a lot more.
It might need regulatory reform, because right now, in order to be big enough to be on a major exchange in a publicly traded company, you have to have a whole department that can file with the SEC, and that's good because it does protect us a little bit from shady investment. On the other hand, it means that little companies that don't have that kind of money are out of the market entirely. And so it either a two-tiered system or some kind of regulatory reform that recognizes smaller companies and maybe smaller risks, you know, might be what's required for that. Do you think, what about this, the age of millennials and the age of entrepreneurship? Are these two made for each other, you think?
Definitely. I think that, you know, millennials, that's a huge buzzword. People love saying that word. But just entrepreneurship in general, I think people who are trying to, you know, they don't want the 9-to-5, their parents, they see kind of that struggle or that mundane for a lot of people, and they want something different, and they want to create it themselves, which I think can be a good and a bad thing. I'm definitely a proponent of the fact that not everybody is meant to be an entrepreneur. Not everybody is meant to start their own company. And a lot of people figure that out as soon as they start, that it isn't easy. And it takes a lot, and it takes certain people, and it, you know, it takes you finding a passion and not just like going after the financial gain of it. So I think that, you know, we have the energy to do it, but we have to remain humble. And that's a huge thing. A lot of people don't do that. They have an ego, and you're never going to learn that way. So I think remaining humble and then really figuring out if this is what is meant for you.
You also, but to remain financially humble is, of course, antithetical to the current logic of kind of Wall Street. You must grow, and you must grow a lot, and bigger is better. That's just the logic that you fight. Do you ask yourself, you know, what's the limit? Is there a point at which a company like yours loses control over the mission if you get big enough to appeal to stockholders in general?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question, something to think about even as we grow production and, you know, where a lot of times food companies can source from local farms. You know, what happens when we grow enough or we need more and we have to source from larger, you know, how do we maintain that quality? And so I think it's really interesting to think about how you scale. And I also would always stress to focus on not just for the investors and what looks good on paper. And I think you have to realize that if you want to do something good, you might have to stay out of the system, right? The system that is, can be corrupt and can be focused on money. So maybe you don't play in that field. Maybe it means that, okay, financially, I'm going to make a little bit less than I could have, but that's okay. I think if you're trying to disrupt an industry or disrupt a way of thinking or way of working, that you have to step aside and you have to do what doesn't seem like the popular thing.
Which means you need a stock market to trade so that your prospectus that says, I'm not going to put financial return on investment number one, we'll be profitable. We're just not going to have to grow 3% a year, and we can still be profitable. And right now, there is not a market for that. So it's kind of an interesting thought. What about back home? Are you an example? Do you go back and give talks? Are people saying, hey, I want to be like Becky?
That's really interesting. I would love to go back. And I mean, Lancaster, the place I grew up, I love those people so much. I have so many fond memories there and so many people in that community that really made me the person I am today. I think finding those opportunities to go back and speak, I probably find them more at Duke, where they're actively trying to, you know, tap into that. So that's something I'd love to do more. It was interesting. The other week, I got a Facebook message from an old high school friend, and they were like, oh, I really want to start this company. I was wondering if you could give me some pointers. And it was really cool. It was a simple exchange, but me taking 5 minutes to say, hey, here's my recommendation. It just felt like a good way of sort of passing that along and to feel like I could be a resource for, even if it's a Facebook message, to just say, hey, reach out to me. I'm available. And if I can help you a little bit and kind of give you a leg up that I didn't have, I'd love to do that.
Have you imagined ways in which you could insert that at the high school level and in those communities just to plant some seeds?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is letting these kids know that no matter where they come from, that they can take steps and they can make something happen. Again, you don't need a $10,000 investment to really give something legs. And so I think at a high school level, whether it's through a class or a program or a workshop, of having them know, okay, you could come up with something and we could take two steps right now to start seeing if they're, market validation, seeing if you could sell it, seeing if people want it, looking at the market. There are plenty of people who have started from nothing. I know a woman who I follow in Alabama who started, she was working for a company, $7 an hour, and started a company off of Instagram and now makes millions of dollars. And phenomenal. It's there. I think going back and giving people the resources and the steps is what they need.
And kids, if you're listening, that tuna fish donut idea, you can have it. I have not patented that. So if you want to run with that, please do. But Becky, thank goodness you didn't. You have a far better product, and I'm happy to talk with you. Becky Holmes, founder and CEO of Ello Raw, a vegan dessert bite company based in Raleigh. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
You can find out more about Becky, her business, and everything we talk about on The State of Things at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Ormond, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Al Budarsky is sitting in today as technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.